And so what we find in many inflammatory skin diseases is that you get a predominance of a pathogen, and in many cases it's Staphylococcus aureus on the skin. And it tends to crowd out that kind of healthy skin microbiome, diverse skin microbiome that you typically have. And, you know, the research is showing that it's because the skin environment itself has changed.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series exploring the skin microbiome. In this series, we speak with experts about some of the latest advances in our understanding of the microbial communities of the skin, including progress towards clinical interventions in dermatology.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And welcome to our new episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast. And today our guest is Dr. Nathan Archer, who's an associate professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in the Department of Dermatology. I'm going to talk about the skin microbiome and the immune system in the skin. Nathan, thank you for joining us. Can you start by giving us some sense of skin architecture? I think a lot of people would think of skin as just an impermeable barrier, you know, essentially almost if we're covered in plastic or something. Well, of course, it's a lot more dynamic than that. And I know just talking about the skin as if it's all the same all over the body is probably already an oversimplification. But could you start there, please?
Yeah, that's a great point. The skin is quite a dynamic organ, and it's why I'm really interested in studying the skin. So we, you know, have different ways of protecting the skin. Like you say, it's not a uniform layer. So first we have different cells. We have the epidermis, and these cells differentiate as they move up in our skin. And as they differentiate, they die. They also form barriers. They produce antimicrobial peptides, antimicrobial lipids, as well as keep the pH of the skin very low. And so all of these have different ways of protecting the skin. A lot of it has to do with keeping moisture in. We want to keep, you know, we want to keep our skin moist. You know, a lot of lotions out there, to, especially in the wintertime. And so it's about, you know, keeping water in and keeping the environment out. And all of these different layers of the skin can help to kind of protect our skin and keep, you know, the things we don't want in the, you know, in the skin out, and the things we do want in to stay in the skin.
And so where in that architecture does the skin microbiome reside?
Yeah, so it resides in a layer called the stratum corneum, which is the uppermost layer of the skin. And this is where, you know, it's overall a hostile environment, but there are microbes that have, you know, adapted to survive on the lipids in the skin, to be able to survive in this low pH environment and really be able to thrive. But it is overall not a very welcoming environment to microbes. And so I think this is why it's been a little harder to research the skin microbiome, because the biomass in the skin is much less than you would find in the gut per se, which, you know, it's a lot easier then to study those gut microbes.
A lot of our listeners would be pretty familiar with what you'd find in the gut, the bacteroides, the bifidobacteria, the yada, yada, yada. On the skin, is it largely gram-positives? Is it streps? Is it like, what are these bacteria? And following on from that, are there also other types of microbes, molds, fungi, parasites, viruses?
Yeah, you'll find a lot of Firmicutes. There's a lot of staphylococcal species. Yeah, strep species as well. Carinibacterium are quite common. And again, it also, you know, I failed to mention before, there's structures in the skin called sebaceous glands and hair follicles that also add different dimensions and environment for microbes to live in. Obviously, see, acne is a huge issue when a hair follicle gets plugged. And, you know, beyond bacteria, there's more research coming out the importance of fungi on the skin. And we find these more in certain parts of the skin, like in the feet, rather than other areas of the body. There's also new research coming out on the importance of the virome on the skin, as well as even mites. So these Demodex mites are found to be now a really important aspect of the skin microbiome per se. But these are newer areas of research and a lot more to come.
Now, Nathan, you've done a lot of work on the bacteria in the skin. Can you talk to us about the commensal bacteria and particularly Staph epidermis and also the pathogenic, you know, Staph aureus and the work you've done on that?
Yeah. So a lot of our research is on pathogenic Staphylococcus aureus and a little bit on Staph epidermidis as well. Staph epidermidis is generally thought to be commensal, but what our research and others have found is that when these bacteria start producing certain types of proteases that are really good at digesting things in the skin, that's when we start to see these bacteria start to become pathogenic and start to instigate inflammation on the skin.
I want to ask a little bit about the difference between, I guess, in the gut. You know, we regard most things that come out in feces as being part of the gut microbiome, even though some may have just been passing through. But on the skin, that must be a real problem. I mean, if I pick up something dirty, then, you know, that's covered in bacteria, then presumably, temporarily at least, my skin is dominated by that contact bacteria rather than what you might consider to be my resident microbiome. How do you discriminate between those two? And how important is it to discriminate between those two?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say this is, you know, why our skin is such an amazing barrier and why most of the time our skin is healthy, right? As I mentioned, it has all of these different mechanisms of protecting you from these exposures, these daily exposures that we have, right? So, you know, I mentioned low pH, skin lipids, antimicrobial peptides, as well as just, you know, the epidermis kind of continually sloughing off, right? Just kind of slowly, like, you know, that's why most of the dust in your house is actually your dead skin cells, right? It's like this is continually happening over time. But, you know, also the skin commensals are there to protect against pathogenic exposures as well. And so there's all these different multi-layers of the skin to protect you from these exposures. But obviously it's not perfect, right? Like things can go wrong. And obviously we get skin infections, we get inflammation from these bacterial exposures. And generally this happens, you know, what we find is this is kind of this acute versus chronic, right? So when you have more chronic inflammation or this chronic exposure is when you're going to start to have larger issues than when your body responds acutely and is able to kind of remove this bacterial exposure from the skin.
So can we talk, Nathan, about how Staph aureus like benefits from disruption in the barrier function and immune dysregulation and microbiotic dysbiosis? Like you've done a lot of amazing work in that regard.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a great topic. And, you know, so I have this garden on the side of our house and we replanted it with native species. And, you know, I see this in the gut world as well, is that, you know, usually health is associated with diversity, right? And when we planted this native garden, we started to see more bugs, more insects, more birds, all, you know, this kind of ecology, this amazing ecology was happening, right? And it's really, you know, supported kind of a healthy ecosystem. Staph and other pathogens do not like this, right? And so what we find in many inflammatory skin diseases is that you get a predominance of a pathogen, and in many cases, it's Staphylococcus aureus on the skin. And it tends to crowd out that kind of healthy skin microbiome, diverse skin microbiome that you typically have. And, you know, the research is showing that it's because the skin environment itself has changed, right? So we may see an increase in pH. We may see a change in the skin lipids on the skin. And this is being shown kind of to be having like a commonality, right? We might see changes in antimicrobial peptide production. We might then start seeing changes. And that's changing now these microbes that can survive on the skin because now you're not in a normal homeostatic environment. And this is just a perfect environment for them, Staphylococcus aureus, for example, to really take off and grow. It kind of loves like this inflammatory environment. And
it seems like your work has even shown that it helps promote that. Like it's a colonizer that is there to break down the barrier and create the cytokines that are going to come in and further disrupt it and make better conditions for it and less good conditions for the other commensals.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct that the work we and others have done have shown that Staph aureus is pro-inflammatory and it really uses these proteases to drive that skin inflammation. And human studies, let's just say for atopic dermatitis patients with dupilumab, which is an anti-IL-4 receptor antibody, that when you block that inflammatory pathway, you start to get skin restoration, and studies are showing that you actually get a decrease in Staph aureus on the skin as well. And so you're changing that environment, that skin environment that's now more beneficial for the skin commensals and less, you know, conducive for Staphylococcus aureus colonization.
So I'm fascinated by this, you know, ecological idea of diversity being obviously a good thing, same in the gut, and preventing access of, say, a Staph aureus or something like that. And in the gut, we always have to worry about people taking antibiotics and maybe denuding their gut of some of their commensals and then pathobionts or pathogens getting in. But, you know, I only see it on TV, of course, but you see surgeons, for example, you know, scrubbing up and maybe three times with these antiseptic soaps. But a lot of people, you know, wash their hands incredibly rigorously, or even shower and you know, use detergents. Does that disrupt the commensal microbiome? And paradoxically, are people who try to stay even cleaner more open to infection because they're causing damage to their existing microbiome?
I would say that it's also when you're doing those things, you're also disrupting that barrier that your skin provides as well, above and beyond just the skin commensals, right? Above reducing that. You know, when you're using the soap and water and wash your hands a lot, you're also removing that protective layer of those dead skin cells. You're removing that protective lipid layer. And so that's also exposing your skin or creating an environment that might be more conducive for pathogenic bacteria to come in and take hold.
Yeah. And is there evidence for that? That like surgeons get more psoriasis or skin infections than people who don't do that? Or, you know, is there any kind of correlation between, yeah, cleanliness and, you know, it would be too completely counterintuitive, I guess, to most people.
Yeah, I would just say overall, there's, you know, data showing that just drier skin and dry environment. So, you know, for the case of atopic dermatitis, it becomes more prevalent in the wintertime. So when you have your skin dries out, the air is drier, right? And it's harder to keep that barrier intact. You know, as I mentioned, certainly adding, you know, using lotions is beneficial for patients as well. And so doing the opposite of that and, you know, using harsh chemicals maybe on your skin, you know, and soaps too aggressively might have the opposite effect, right?
And I understand that maybe I've got the figures wrong now, but about 50% of people carry Staph aureus as a normal commensal member on their skin, particularly maybe on their faces. Why are these ones being held in check? Whereas normal, you know, in a case of psoriasis or atopic dermatitis, they get out of control.
Yeah, so in normal skin, the levels of Staph aureus are quite low. And I do think that is kept in check, and that may be a transient colonization as well. And my graduate school work was actually on studying why people are persistently colonized with Staph aureus in the nose. And so this is a very consistent phenomenon that about a third of the population is persistently colonized with Staphylococcus aureus in the nasal cavity. And there's many studies showing that that persistent nasal colonization definitely makes you at increased risk of skin infections, as well as increased risk of atopic dermatitis and other infections associated with Staph aureus. And that, you know, we studied the immune response in that aspect to kind of dictate why some people would and wouldn't. But again, why Staph aureus is not pathogenic in that environment, I don't think we fully appreciate and understand. And there needs to be more research done to understand that. If there's some sort of molecular trigger, metabolite trigger, or some change in the environment that helps to trigger that change in Staph aureus.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about your career and how it started and how it's now, you know, developing the evidence for like the skin-lung axis in particular? Just what would you like scientists to know about the connections there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we've always been interested in studying Staph aureus in the skin. And like I said, my graduate school research was in the nasal cavity. And there's this concept called the atopic march, where children or patients who develop atopic dermatitis, which is frequently colonized and exacerbated by Staphylococcus aureus, are at greater risk of developing other allergic disorders, such as food allergy, chronic rhinosinusitis, as well as asthma. And so we developed a model in our lab to study what role Staph aureus might be playing in this exacerbation of skin inflammation, as well as atopic March diseases. And in this case, we are interested in understanding asthma. And so we developed a model where we put an allergen on the skin with Staph aureus, or with and without Staph aureus on the skin, and then added that allergen into the lung later on. And what we found is if we had Staph aureus just on the skin, that their lung inflammation due to this allergic reaction was exacerbated. And also it created a type of inflammation that is much harder to treat in patients. So it's called neutrophilic asthma. And these patients with neutrophilic asthma are much more resistant to conventional therapies. And so it's a really important population to study.
And, you know, the appearance of the skin is, I don't know, at the root of a lot of people's self-identity, I guess, even, you know, I mean, obviously having psoriasis or some kind of, you know, prominent skin condition is very debilitating for people. And a lot of people obviously use a lot of lotions and makeup and, you know, things to try and disguise, I guess, blemishes and things on the skin. What's the feeling about the impact of those kind of, not treatments, but cosmetic treatments on the skin microbiome? Is there any, have people been looking at that, the impact of makeup, for example, or lots of lotion? I mean, go into the local supermarket and there are shelves after shelves of lotions promising all different kinds of rewards for the user. What's your view on those?
Yeah, I think research is somewhat limited on cosmetics per se in the skin microbiome. I think there is, you know, a big push on, you know, making sure you have, you know, replacing these components of the skin barrier that are usually deficient when you have inflammatory skin diseases, such as psoriasis and atopic dermatitis. So you'll usually find ceramides in a lot of lotions, which is usually deficient in these patients, and that helps to restore that barrier. But I think in understanding, does it resolve that lack of diversity or does it help to promote diversity? I think there is certainly more research to be done on that.
And in the gut, we use prebiotics a lot to try to restore some of those good microbes. Is there an equivalent for the skin microbiome? Are there things you can feed to try and maybe support Staph epidermidis and things? But or is there always a risk you support Staph aureus as well at the same time?
Yeah. Well, I would say that there is some research showing that Staph epidermidis does have enzymes that do affect the ceramide levels on the skin in a good way, and help to promote ceramide. So perhaps, you know, feeding these you know, lipids and ceramides that are in lotions may help to support that population on the skin. And kind of to that topic, we are, you know, have new research in the lab showing that Staph aureus is actively dampening those protective lipids on the skin. And this is a really new exciting area for us that we think this is helping Staph aureus to colonize the skin by reducing that protective antimicrobial lipid barrier. And, you know, as kind of a prebiotic to that point as well, that a lot of bacteria on the skin are using these lipids as a fuel source as well. And so if Staph aureus is reducing, you know, the lipid production on the skin, that might be affecting their ability to survive on the skin, taking away a food source, as well as reducing these antimicrobial lipids that normally would keep Staph in check. And so we think that Staph aureus is actively doing this, and maybe why we see Staph aureus so commonly colonized in these inflammatory skin conditions.
So Nathan, I want to talk a little bit about your experimental models. Like, you developed this epicutaneous model for Staph aureus. Have you thought about, or have you engaged in like co-inoculation to see if something like Staph epidermidis might have beneficial effects on lipid, but also moisture and barrier function, and how that may or may not have a synergistic effect on Staph aureus?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something we haven't done yet, but I do think it's really interesting to pursue to see whether these commensal microbes might be actually promoting healthy skin lipid production, and if that might be able to counterbalance the reduction that Staph aureus is causing on the skin. Because in our model, we are using like a very high amount of Staph aureus to really kind of bring out these effects, right? And so I will say that there are other groups that have found staphylococcal commensals that have anti-staphylococcal aureus activity. And so they found that these skin commensals produce antimicrobial peptides that help to kill Staph aureus, as well as finding this, it's called quorum sensing peptides as well, that target Staph aureus and help to reduce their numbers. And they've actually brought these to clinical trials. And so this is, I think, a really exciting avenue, is identifying these skin commensals that have anti-Staph aureus activity to help restore a normal skin barrier in patients.
I'm curious, Nathan, you know, in again, my reference point is nearly always the gut microbiome. And we believe there are a lot of, or sometimes are missing microbes from, you know, ancient humans. And we can see those sometimes in humans that live in hunter-gatherer groups. Have people looked at the skin microbiome of people living in these hunter-gatherer type communities? And is it significantly different from the modern Western kind of skin microbiome?
That is something I have not seen yet, but there are certainly, you know, changes between people living in different environments, certainly. But whether hunter gatherers, I have not seen that study, but I think that would be really exciting and maybe a new source of protective microbes that we in the Western or developed world have maybe lost over time.
And there's a lot of evidence in the gut that many autoimmune diseases like IBD and so on, you know, there's a hygiene hypothesis, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that it's our lack of exposure to microbes that is generating the conditions into which these chronic diseases are thriving. Is there a similar hygiene hypothesis for psoriasis, atopic dermatitis and so on? Is it less prevalent in populations that don't have the same level of hygiene as us?
Yeah, that's certainly an exciting area of study. And there's studies showing that there's an important window in childhood. And when you're first born, there's a window. And when you have these anti-inflammatory T cells come into the skin, and this is when they get educated on what to respond to and what not to respond to. And so if you're in an environment where you're not exposed to these, you know, commensal bacteria, and you now later your body sees them as a foe, that's going to make you much more susceptible to skin inflammation. It's going to, you know, make your microbiome not as healthy of a microbiome as if you saw these as, you know, friends to your skin rather than enemies. And certainly, you know, where you live and what exposures you have very early in life can really have a huge impact on your susceptibility to these inflammatory diseases later in life.
Yeah, I believe that the hygiene hypothesis even originated in the context of childhood diseases of allergy and things like that in like the late 1980s or so. Nathan, speaking of childhood and trying to protect ourselves against Staph aureus, I know early on in your career, you were involved in vaccine development. And I think you're still involved in that. What would you like our listeners to know about vaccine development for a very difficult to deal with organism like Staph aureus?
Yeah, it has been kind of a sticking point in the staph world as well, that all vaccines so far have failed. But I have not given up hope, and I hope, you know, the community and scientists at large have not given up hope on this. And the reason this is so difficult is I like to say Staph aureus is like the Swiss Army knife of bacteria. It has so many tools and so many virulence factors that can avoid our immune responses, help it survive in very hostile environments. And you can't have just one target, right? You can't have just maybe one antigen that you are going to produce this vaccine against. And so the strategy now is producing multivalent vaccines that target multiple of Staph aureus's virulence factors. We're working with a company right now that's developing a multivalent toxoid vaccine. So it's targeting multiple toxins that target our immune system and various immune cells. And that's actually in phase one clinical trials right now. So, fingers crossed that this is the one that works and there's success there. So, yeah, so there's still hope on the horizon for a Staph aureus vaccine and hopefully can prevent inflammatory skin diseases that are affected by Staph aureus as well.
That sounds really exciting. Can we conclude, and we don't normally ask our guests to do this, but in the case of the skin, I think a lot of people would be interested. Can you almost advise people on what's the best way to maintain healthy skin in terms of a cleaning regimes or anything, any advice you have for people who want to maintain healthy skin?
Yes. I am not a dermatologist, but I am in the dermatology department. You know, I think like most things, it's, you know, your diet, your stress levels, you know, don't smoke. There's a lot of, you know, obesity is associated with increased inflammatory skin conditions. So I think there are a lot of things that are in our control, you know, get, you know, exercise to help, you know, reduce stress and weight. You know, as well as, you know, maybe try to avoid using harsh soaps and other skin products. And yeah, I would say those are, you know, some kind of basic, you know, things. And if you are getting dry skin, you know, using lotions, you know, potentially with ceramides in them, or go see your dermatologist as well, you know, highly recommend. So yeah, so and there, you know, are a lot of new treatments out there as well. If you do have an inflammatory skin condition, there are a lot of biologics on the market that have really helped many patients and I think have opened a lot of doors for treatments.
I think that's really good advice. Thank you, Nathan. And thank you so much for joining us today. We've really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, it's been great to be here. And thank you for the invitation.
Thank you, Nathan.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. And check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.